Court will proceed to the sixth case of the day, Hill v. Potter.
May it please the Court, my name is Matthew Walsh from Latham & Watkins. I'm here representing Carla Hill. Since 2002, Ms. Hill has asserted various claims against John Potter, the Postmaster General of the United States Postal Service, for discrimination, and specifically alleged that her supervisors at the Postal Service retaliated against her for her pursuit of those discrimination claims in violation of the applicable labor laws. On June 16, 2009, the District Court entered summary judgment dismissing Ms. Hill's retaliation claims against the Postal Service. The District Court erred when it entered that summary judgment because it made a host of improper factual determinations in favor of the movement to reach that decision. As a consequence, the District Court's entry of summary judgment should be reversed and the case should be remanded so that the jury of Ms. Hill's peers can weigh the competing evidence presented on these issues. Hill's retaliation claim relates to two different sets of actions by the Postal Service. The first is a decision made in September of 2003 to put her on light duty and subsequently use that light duty decision to charge her 618 hours of leave without pay, which cost her approximately $12,000 in salary over a six-month period. The second is a series of decisions made between 2005 and 2007 in which the Postal Service promoted three individuals over Ms. Hill for a coveted window clerk position with the Postal Service in the Hazelcrest facility. I'll discuss first the leave without pay decision. The District Court erred when it found that Ms. Hill was not subject to a material adverse employment action when the USPS placed her on light, when the Postal Service placed her on light duty and charged her 618 hours in leave without pay. The District Court's decision is in one paragraph on this point. And in that paragraph, the District Court essentially says that Ms. Hill has not shown that the placement of her on light duty and the charging of leave without pay constituted an adverse employment action. Facts of the case, though, show that, in fact, Ms. Hill was placed on light duty by the OWCP after her supervisor reached out to the OWCP and said to them, controvert her claim. And this was done after, of course, Ms. Hill had engaged in a series of actions protected by the EEO against this supervisor, amongst others. Then that supervisor, along with his right-hand man, James Fiscaldo, proceeded to exercise the discretion afforded them by her being on light duty to charge her with 618 hours of leave without pay. We have presented evidence which demonstrates that this significant reduction in her work hours constitutes an adverse employment action. And there's substantial, the case law is clear on this question that reducing the hours of somebody to fail to work constitutes an adverse action. The District Court, in entering summary judgment on that issue, simply overlooked the Postal Service's involvement in getting her on light duty in the first place, and instead merely said that there was no change in her light duty status because she had no guarantee of 40 hours of employment because she was on light duty. As we explained in our brief, the combination of putting her on light duty and the charging of leave without pay constitutes an adverse action. The Postal Service, in its response brief, raises three arguments as to why the District Court's decision should be affirmed, none of which really focus on the District Court's decision. The first is they claim that Ms. Hill has waived her argument with respect to arguing about the decision to put her on light duty, and we, as we have explained in our reply brief, believe that has not been waived. As we clearly stated in discovery and in our summary judgment brief, our perspective and Ms. Hill's view and the facts that support the notion that The Postal Service engaged in retaliation by putting her on light duty and by charging her leave without pay. The Postal Service also argues that that it's not responsible for the actions of OWCP. However, as we again explained in our reply brief, there's ample evidence to demonstrate that the Postal Service was a significant influence in that process, and the Shanger v. Upjohn case supports the view that the Postal Service is responsible for that conduct under the cat's paw theory of liability. Finally, the Postal Service argues that there are no similarly situated employees to Ms. Hill in this circumstance. However, as we've stated in our briefs and as we stated in the district court, there is ample evidence that there were significant employees like Ms. Hill, many employees like Ms. Hill, who were capable of doing work and, in fact, did 40 hours of work and much more. Over 800 hours of overtime was done during this time period that Ms. Hill was charged leave without pay. All of this, we believe, presents a factual issue that needs to be weighed by a trier of fact before the court should dismiss the claim asserted by Ms. Hill. Now, the second area or set of decisions that we have addressed in our complaint and that Ms. Hill pursued involved the failure to promote her to the window clerk position. This issue focuses primarily on a factual determination as to what exactly was the Postal Service's practices in promoting individuals who wanted to become window clerks. There is a significant factual dispute on this question, although if you read the Postal Service's brief, you wouldn't think that, since they say in various times that it was admitted by us or not contested, or in fact that the defendant actually acknowledged in her declaration that there was a policy which required employees interested in the window clerk position to submit written applications to each supervisor who came into the Postal Service office. However, those facts are not true. In fact, this is a hotly contested issue in the record. We've presented substantial factual evidence which would show that there is no such policy. First of all, there's the United States Postal Service's manual itself. That's Exhibit 12 to R57 in the record, in which the standards are identified as looking to someone with senior or best qualified qualifications, which makes sense for someone of the window clerk position to be either have high seniority or be best qualified for the position. In interrogatory responses provided by the Postal Service on two different occasions, both an initial response and a supplemental response, there isn't a single mention of a first-to-apply policy, let alone...
Well, let's assume there is a genuine issue of material fact about whether there's a policy. Don't we have the odd circumstance of no application for the position?
Well, actually, I think that's also a factual issue, too, because Ms. Hill has stated that she did apply for the position. She applied in 2000. She applied for it again in 2003, both in writing and acknowledged by the Postal Service. She also expressed interest in the position through a settlement agreement that the supervisor who promoted the first two individuals, Mr. Viscalda, was aware of. So he knew that she was interested in the position. And then the third one, Ms. Green, promoted Ms. McGee in 2007. And in Ms. Hill has made clear in her declaration that she specifically told Ms. Green of her interest in the position. So she applied. And how did Ms. McGee get the position? Ms. Green went to her and told her to submit a written application for it. So in other words, there wasn't like a written application by Ms. McGee in the record before Ms. Hill had expressed her interest in the position. So even under their policy, if there was really a first-to-apply policy, Ms. Hill should have got the job. The fact is the record doesn't support such a policy. And so the Seventh Circuit has made it clear that the summary judgment standard is to be applied with added rigor in employment cases where intent and credibility are crucial issues. And the appellate court should only affirm decisions made by the district court, and I quote, if had the record before the court been the record of a complete trial, the defendant would have been entitled to a directed verdict, close quote. That's from Sarsha v. Sears, Roebuck & Co. The record before the district court in this case comes nowhere near justifying the entry of such a verdict. Rather, the court placed the burden on the plaintiff to show the non-existence of a promotion policy, and the court challenged the plaintiff's position regarding the charging of leave without pay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Mr. Lane?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ernest Lane.
Good morning, that is.
Just made it 1 minute before, Your Honor.
I'm not speaking to the merits of the case.
Shortly before the end of the morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Ernest Lane for the United States Postal Service. The only issue here is whether the plaintiff has presented enough evidence that the stated reasons that the Hazelcrest Postal Management for its employment decisions, assuming those decisions were actually adverse employment actions within the meaning of the employment discrimination statutes, were actually pretext or lies covering up illegal retaliation. However, Ms. Hill did not present sufficient evidence to show that those stated reasons were pretextual or were lies, and therefore the district court properly granted summary judgment. Now, as this court has held, in order to defeat summary judgment, the plaintiff has to present more than a mere scintilla of evidence or evidence that creates only a metaphysical doubt in response to the evidence that was presented here by the Postal Service, but she didn't, and in fact, Hill's entire appeal consists of questioning the rationale for the reasons given by Hazelcrest Postal Management for either the selection of the window clerk positions or for making work assignments, and that's simply not enough. She has to show that the Hazelcrest Postal Management's proffered reasons are a lie, as stated by this court in Johnson versus Nordstrom, 260 Fed 3rd, 727 at 732. Postal Management, to paraphrase, it may be mistaken, cruel, unethical, out of its head, or downright irrational, but so long as it really believes the reasons for its decisions, its reason for those actions are not pretextual. And I submit that nothing presented by Ms. Hill in this case does so, and summary judgment should there be affirmed. So what, in essence, what Ms. Hill is arguing on appeal is that because she presented some evidence that may have conflicted with the evidence that was presented by the Postal Service, that summary judgment should have been denied and she should be entitled to a hearing in front of a jury or some other fact finder on that. But that evidence is a misunderstanding of the nature of summary judgment. As this court has stated once again, summary judgment is the put-up or shut-up moment in litigation where the party responding to summary judgment has to show that there is enough evidence raising material issues of fact, which require a trial by jury. The district court's decision here showed that it carefully analyzed the depositions, the declarations, and other material presented both by the Postal Service and Ms. Hill in opposition to the Postal Service's motion for summary judgment and correctly concluded that there was no material issue of fact requiring trial. Now, I want to address some of the issues that were raised by Ms. Hill. And I think we can categorize those as work assignments or denial of hours and this transfer issue. Now, the district court, there was no evidence. The only evidence in this case is that the determination, there are two types of injury-related assignments that can be made pursuant to Department of Labor regulations, which is administered through the Office of Workers' Compensation Program. Those are limited-duty assignments and for work-related injuries and light-duty assignments for non-work-related injuries. In both cases, the employee has to apply through the Department of Labor, and the Department of Labor is the final arbiter of whether something is work-related and therefore limited duty or light duty, and which is not work-related but is an assignment with physical restrictions. In this case, Ms. Hill was actually on limited duty at one point and then claimed to have re-injured herself and once again submitted an application to Department of Labor, and this time Department of Labor said, no, the injury is not work-related. We're rejecting your limited duty application. It's not related. Therefore, it's light duty. So there's no question that both under the regulations and in the evidence in this case, that the decision to place Ms. Hill on light duty as opposed to limited duty was not the decision of the Postal Service. It was just the decision of Department of Labor. And that has some significance here, because under the Department of Labor regulations, when one is considered a limited duty employee rehabilitating from work-related injuries, the employer, the Postal Service, is required to give them a 40-hour, minimum 40-hour work week. But there is no such requirement when the employee is on light duty. And in this situation, it is uncontested that that's what Ms. Hill was on at the time. The only evidence that she can try to muster in response to this is that there's some type of conspiracy between the Postal Service, or that the Department of Labor was just some type of cat's paw or surrogate acting for the Postal Service. But there's no evidence of this. It's just argument. And I think all of the cases that she cited, the Shager case, the Phelan case, or the Deadman case, those are inapplicable, because in those situations there actually was evidence. Here, the Department of Labor, it's uncontested. It's a separate federal agency. It's not the Postal Service. They're two different entities. On the issue of similarly situated employees, the Postal Management's reason for sending home Ms. Hill early was that there was no work for her to be performed within her physical limitations. In fact, she testified during her own deposition at page 3132, which can be found at record site 49, that she had significant physical limitations that prevented her from working a full 40-hour work week or extra additional work at that level. That is why this evidence of other people being allowed to work overtime is irrelevant. It's not adequate evidence of pretext. Not only is there an issue of them not, there is no evidence that they were subject to the same type of physical restrictions or same type of light duty, there's also no evidence that those people had ever filed the EEO activity, which is what she's saying is a basis of a retaliation claim. I want to get to the issue of these transfer positions. And I think, Judge Flom, you pointed out the most obvious thing there. She never applied for any of these positions, or there isn't any credible evidence, or there isn't any evidence in the record that she ever did apply for the positions. Having failed to apply for the positions, as this court has held in other cases, you can't very well complain that you suffered an adverse reaction when you were adverse action when you're passed over for those positions. Now, she suggests that there should be some kind of general institutionalized atmospheric knowledge that she was interested in the positions. And she said that, well, you know, I applied for the position in 2000, in writing for the position in 2000 and in 2003. And that undercuts, number one, that undercuts her position that she didn't know that there was this policy in place by Hazelcrest Management to require applicants to apply in writing for these positions. And number two, it shows that she's generally knowledgeable about when these positions would become available as well. Now, there is testimony, deposition testimony by both Hazelcrest Management and the other employees that were selected, that they were aware that this policy was in place, that they required the applications to be in writing, and that the applicants, in fact, made written applications for these three positions other than Ms. Hill. It's not a situation where, well, so every single one of the applicants that was selected made a written application. That's the evidence. The evidence is that the Postal Service, that the Postal Management required such application to be made. And if these positions were in such high demand as what Ms. Hill is arguing, then I think it makes eminent sense for the local management to require people to indicate their interest in the property, interest in the positions by applying in writing. And I think that's where their citation to the postal, the National Postal Regulation, is not fatal to this question. The provision of the national regulation that they cite to states that these positions may be awarded to people showing interest in the positions. I don't know how you would determine who has interest in the positions unless it was expressed, and in this case, she clearly never expressed an interest in those positions. I see my time is up. Unless there are other questions from the court, we would ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wayne. Mr. Walsh, your time has expired, but you may have a minute.
I just want to make 2 points in response to argument from counsel for the Postal Service. First of all, with respect to the decision to put Ms. Hill on light duty, there is evidence in the record of a conspiracy. In fact, we pointed to it in our brief. R57 Exhibit 3 is the letter submitted by Mr. Kavanaugh directly to OWCP stating controvert the claim. Second of all, we cited the declaration of Ms. Hill in which she explained that the whole reason she applied for a recurrence of injury to the OWCP was because Mr. Kavanaugh told her to, and it in fact was the wrong form for her to fill out. So there's evidence of that conspiracy. Second of all, on the question about the application to the for the promotion, Mr. Ling says there's no credible evidence of that application, and maybe a slip of tongue there, but that's exactly what summary judgment's about, is not to decide the credibility of the evidence, but simply to look at the evidence, and if there's a competing, if there is a disputed issue of fact on that evidence, and in this case we submit there is, summary judgment should be denied. And the atmospheric knowledge was not something that Ms. Hill said. That was, in fact, something that the court, district court, said. Ms. Hill has stated very clearly in both her deposition testimony and in her declaration that she made it very clear to her supervisors that she was interested in the job. Mr. Fiscaldo acknowledged he knew she was interested in the job, and Mr. Green also acknowledged that she knew she was interested in the job. So we submit that the record evidence does support the notion that she had applied or expressed her interest in being a window clerk.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Mr. Ling, Mr. Walsh. Case taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.